What does disability have to do with identity? What language should we use to talk about disability? Why does that matter? How can the experience of blindness involve beauty, power, and loss all at the same time? I'm Amy Julia Becker, and this is Reimagining the Good Life, a podcast about challenging the assumptions about what makes life good, proclaiming the inherent belovedness of every human being, and envisioning a world of belonging. I'm here today with Andrew Leland, author of The Country of the Blind, a memoir at the end of sight. This was such a rich conversation. Andrew Leland is a writer, an audio producer, editor, and teacher living in Western Massachusetts. His book is about the world of blindness and figuring out his place in it. And it combines all the aspects of a memoir that make for a good story while also delving into philosophy and ethics and politics and history and disability studies. So when I was reading it, I both enjoyed myself as a reader and I also learned a lot, which is no small feat. So you are going to enjoy learning and listening as he shares his story today as well, I am sure. But before I turn this over to our conversation, I also wanted to tell you about three upcoming speaking events that might be of interest. So one, for those of you who are listening on the day this episode drops, February 20th, I will be speaking tonight virtually for the Virginia Down Syndrome Association about setting our kids up to thrive as adults. So if you are a parent of a child with Down syndrome in particular, you might be interested in that. Two, I'm speaking in another virtual event on Friday, March 1st for the Trinity Forum. That talk is called Perfectly Human, Why Understanding Disability Matters to All of Us. And three, I will be speaking in person in Matthews, North Carolina at Matthews United Methodist Church on March 3rd. I'll be preaching in all three services and then offering a separate talk that evening. We will put a link in the show notes with more information about all three of these events and how to register for the virtual ones. All right, here's my conversation with Andrew Leland. Well, I am so grateful to be sitting here with my guest, Andrew Leland, today. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I first read an essay of yours in The New Yorker last summer, and it was super compelling. It was called How to Be Blind. We will link to it in the show notes. And that is what prompted me to read your book, which is called The Country of the Blind. And honestly, I try not to gush about guests because it makes it seem like I, you know, have no critical ability to assess your work or something, but I really can't gush enough about your book. And it just is thrilling to me to get to have a conversation with you here today. So thank you very much again.
Thank you.
And I thought maybe one of the things you reference in the book is that you worked on it for years. I mean, I think at one point you said 10 years. And so I thought maybe you could tell us about you and the book by talking about the process of writing it. So if that seems like a way into learning about you and about the topic of your book, why don't we start there?
Sure. Yeah. 10 years is maybe ambitious estimate. I don't think it was quite that long. Although with a book like this, you know, there's definitely pieces of writing that, you know, we're in journal entries going back at least that far. But there was really, I would say, 3 years of like really intensive, concentrated writing and revising. But yeah, because it's so much about an experience that lasted, you know, 20 years or more of gradually losing vision over that period, it feels like, you know, I was gestating it for that long. But yeah, so I, you know, I was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa or RP when I was a teenager. And at that time, it was really manifesting as night blindness. So I would notice that I was worse than my friends at wandering around the woods at night or finding my seat in the movie theater, you know. And then from that point, from the point of sort of self-diagnosis a couple years later to, you know, getting an official diagnosis, you know, every 2 to 5 years, there would be another milestone of some kind, you know, maybe at some point in my 20s, I thought driving at night doesn't feel safe, but I can still drive during the day. That feels fine. You know, and then driving during the day and then riding a bike. And, you know, I sort of made it through all these milestones, and I had it in the back of my head, like, this is an experience that would probably be worth writing about. At least mm-hmm. it would be interesting. You know, maybe there's a novel or something, but it always, blindness always really felt distant in a way still, even through those milestones. Cause like I would stop driving at night, but then I would just be like walking around town without a cane. Just like, what do I have to do with blindness? And then mm-hmm. it was about 8 years ago or so now that when I moved to Massachusetts, I decided to just, I owned a white cane. I kept it folded up in my bag all the time. And I really only used it if I was like by myself in a dark place that I knew I was going to like spill a beer on somebody or step on somebody's foot or something like that.
Yeah.
But then when I moved to Massachusetts, I just thought, okay, this would be helpful to use more. I'm sort of so ashamed of it. I'm just going to use it all the time. And then as soon as I made that decision, blindness became really front and center in the way people saw me, the way I saw myself, you know, from strangers to family members. And that was really the beginning of the writing process, because that social transformation everywhere I went, inside or out, was sort of unavoidable, and it was just in my face. And then I started to find pathways outward from it. In other words, it wasn't just like about my own experience and my own obsessing over it. It was pointing towards interesting questions about identity and technology and literature and, you know, all these sort of things that I was already interested in anyway. So then there was this sort of snowball effect. And then I started kind of like working seriously. And then I, you know, I don't know how much of the kind of publishing-y details you want, but basically that turned into finding an agent who helped me understand what a book proposal was, and then sold that. And then that bought me 3 years to really hunker down and just focus on writing the book.
Yeah, that's amazing. Just that you were able to do. So this is your first book.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's just, it's such a feat of a book in and of itself, but that's even more as someone who's written a number of books. It is quite something. So, well, there are a couple places I want to go, and I think let's hit on the identity question because you brought it up. This comes up a couple times in the book that you write about how some people see blindness as an attribute or a characteristic and others as an identity. Mm-hmm. Could you start just by reflecting on the difference between those two for, you know, listeners who don't quite know what I mean when I give those two options, and then mm-hmm. also how you see yourself within those two possibilities?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the first places that my research brought me when I started to look into blindness was the National Federation of the Blind, or the NFB. And they are important for a number of reasons. They're the kind of organized blind movement is one way they refer to themselves. And this sort of beginning of, in this country at least, but I think, you know, in the history of blindness, it's an important moment where blind people say, you know, we're not reliant on sighted people to sort of, you know, create services for us. We are, we are the National Federation of the Blind. And their philosophy has been really influential and also really controversial among blind people. You know, they're not afraid of causing trouble, you know, and they're activists. But one of the things that one of their leaders and many of their leaders have talked about is this idea that blindness is a neutral characteristic. It's sort of an incidental characteristic, mm-hmm. like hair color, let's say. And, you know, which is a pretty radical idea if you tell the average person on the street, like, oh yeah, blindness, like that's just like hair color, or mm-hmm. like that you happen to, you know, the color of a house. But it's powerful, you know, and it connects to a bigger idea in disability, the sort of social model, which is mm-hmm. this idea that it's, you know, it's not blindness that's the problem. It's the fact that all the textbooks are only available in print, or, you know, it's not having a mobility disability that's the problem. It's the fact that you built a school that only has stairs as an entrance.
Yeah.
And if you look at it in those terms, the attribute can be sort of neutral or incidental, But then as I started thinking about that, you know, that blindness is not what defines you is one of the NFB's sort of mm-hmm. taglines. You know, then I started kind of running against this this apparent contradiction in my mind of like, okay, so if it's incidental, then why are you the National Federation of the Blind? Like, and you're a proud blind person. And like, where does this sort of centrality of the identity come in? And how is it in conversation with the sort of fact that it doesn't mean anything, right? It's mm-hmm. it's just incidental. And that really, in some ways, is the animating question of the book and of my own life as I sort of edge closer and closer to, you know, real blindness, whatever real blindness might mean. You know, how am I gonna conceive of it? And so, yeah, you asked me, I guess, as part of your question, like, where do I fit?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think for myself, and I think in thinking about a lot of other blind people I've spoken to, they're often, and also just, I think the way people experience identity, there's not often a fixed answer, right? Like on some days it is central, and on other days it's not. And there's some hours, you know, and I think one example that I think about is comparing it to like gender. Like, you know, there are times when my identity as a man feels central, right? Like mm-hmm. if I'm doing manly thing, whatever, you know, if I'm like, you know, being a father, right? Like in some ways being fatherly is like a sort of quintessentially masculine feeling thing, which is, that can be contested in any number of ways, but I'll just go with it for the sake of argument. But then like there's other times when I'm like eating lunch and it's not like I'm eating the salad as a man, or like, you know, national identity is another one, right? Like at immigration, you know, when I'm in line for customs, like being an American, pretty central thing. I'm like gripping my passport, holding it up, you know, but I'm not like an American. I'm not making an American grilled cheese sandwich. I'm just like a dude making a grilled cheese sandwich. Yeah. And so I think disability works like that too. And the last thing I'll say about it is that often discrimination or, you know, prejudice can be a factor in driving how you relate to it. So in other words, like I could just be walking down the street as a guy going to pick his kid up from school, but then somebody says, "Oh, sir, let me help you across the street." And suddenly I'm forced into like being a blind man. And there was nothing about me or my day that needed to, but then there's this sort of external force that pushes me in one way or the other.
I was struck when you were speaking, I have so many thoughts. And one is, again, like the social model of disability and how it can be really helpful, but also limited. I even think about the fact that I have two daughters who wear glasses, and I have used that as a way to explain a social model of disability, which in and of itself might be problematic because I'm saying to them, well, when you put your glasses on, you can see. And so you're no longer disabled, and you wouldn't have think of yourself as someone with a disability because you have your glasses. Mm-hmm. And yet that's still saying the way to be able in this world is to be able to see with your eyes, right? Like, it's interesting. I mean, I've just thought about that literally for the first time as you were speaking. I'm like, oh, is my analogy not really that helpful? Or is it a way, because I want them to understand that using a wheelchair is a way to get from here to there, not a mark of not being able to do something. And that there are ways in which we always are living. And you make this point that like technology is always about expanding human possibility. And I think, so there's a part of me that feels like the limitations that come with disability are just a magnification of the limitations that come with humanity. Yeah. And so there's a very blurry line if we really want to try to define disability and not. I also think it can be helpful. I mean, I know that it is helpful from like a political perspective to define disability so that there are like rights and protections and services that and supports, whether that is like, yes, you get to go to school here or you get to have a job here. So I think there's the questions you are asking in this book run in lots of those different directions. And I think it's helpful to kind of push the point a little bit. The last thing I'll say here, and then I would love to hear your response, is just that you describe being at a convention with, I don't know, hundreds, thousands of other people. Yeah. And on the one hand, it was kind of this liberating experience. And on the other hand, it was exhausting.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, that you could say like, blindness becomes a characteristic because everybody's blind. And so who cares? Mm-hmm. And yet, on the other hand, the amount of kind of energy it took for you to be there was somewhat overwhelming.
Totally. Yeah, yeah, that's so, so interesting.
Know. Respond to whatever you want from what I just said.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's a lot in what you just said. And I think it comes down to the idea of norms, you know, and there's this idea of what a normal person can do. Mm-hmm. I'm very mm-hmm. influenced by the writing of Sarah Hendren. I don't know if
Me
you know
too.
Her book.
Yes. Yeah, what she's can been a body on this do? Podcast before.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
And you know, and I think she makes that point that I kind of borrow in my book about, you know, we think about assistive technology, but really all technology is assistive technology. Like mm-hmm. I use magnifiers and a screen reader to write and to read. But those are extending my capabilities. There's really no difference between that dynamic and someone using their high-speed internet connection to zoom into work, or their car to drive to work, or mm-hmm. shoes to walk across a freezing tarmac, you know, whatever. And the difference is, as you suggest, like just about norms, like what the sort of majority of people kind of have socially agreed to accept as like normal and not yeah. in need of an accommodation. And then there's this blurry boundary line where if you're on the outside of it, then you are disabled and you do need one. So I think, yeah, I mean, I'm just in some ways just echoing what you just said, but I think you're getting at that kind of two different, seemingly opposite, but not actually opposed ways of thinking about disability, where on the one hand, it is just part of this experience of accommodation, but like reframing accommodation as just like, you know, we all have different methods of accessing the world and of inhabiting the world. And traditionally those can be stigmatized, and it's like, oh, you have special needs because you're disabled. But in fact, like we all have special needs. It's just like some needs get labeled special and others don't. But then at the same time, yeah, your point is really well taken, that we don't want to just erase that difference, because there's something really important politically and socially about recognizing the difference. And again, I think it comes down to context. Like, you know, just as there are times when I just want to be a guy eating a salad, and there are times when like I want people to be aware of the fact that I'm not going to see them. You know, I think there are times when we need to be mindful of that difference, and times when it's actually really harmful to center it. And yeah, and I think, so I think I run into trouble, and people run into trouble when you want to have like a rule, and people are just like, just tell me what the right words are and what the right framework is. But I think it's much more about, you know, are we talking about building a system, or is it about just moving within that system, is maybe one random idea I have for, yeah, I'm all over the place over here.
Yeah, well, that's because I took you in 17 directions, so thank you for trying to corral me. But it makes me also think about the ways in which, on the one hand, it's easy to try to insist, like, kind of we're all the same, and we just have, you know, again, even using the language that I often do, like different limitations, different challenges, mm-hmm. different gifts, you know, and yet how we also can – I find myself running into, as the mother of a child with Down syndrome, what I've learned to call false equivalences, where I will talk about, a concern I have related to Penny when she was younger, like socially in school and just not having friends. And my friends who had typically developing kids would say, oh, yeah, middle school is really hard when it comes to friendship. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you're not hearing me. Like, this mm-hmm. is not a typical hardship. This is I am alone at lunch every day and no one is ever noticing me. And that's different. Like, it really is. And so I would end up being, they were trying to make a connection to me, and I would feel more alone because it was like, you don't actually know what I'm talking about. Mm. And so there's something real about saying, yeah, middle school is hard. And there's also something real about saying, and yet there's something different about the experience of having a disability in middle school than just being a typical kid. Mm-hmm. And I think what I wonder is whether some of that comes down to time or energy. I mean, I think some of it is norms and like social prejudices and things like that. But that was something I was thinking about in reading your book as well, that and you write about how it's not fair or right, like it's not accurate for me to put on a double eye patch. That's language I learned from you.
Sure, yeah.
Rather than a blindfold, right? A double eye patch.
Yeah.
and try to navigate my house versus someone who has had the experience of not using their eyes to get around for a while. Like, those aren't the same things.
Right.
And yet it still, I think, takes more time to get through the world if you're using a cane than it does for me.
Right.
And I wonder whether that is something that almost those of us who want to be in kind of the disability advocacy space want to pretend isn't true, the like time and energy aspect of things, because we live in such like an efficient productivity oriented society that values that so much that we're like, no. As long as we make all the proper accommodations, we can all be superheroes. Don't you worry. I don't know. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. And it's just so tricky to pull those pieces apart. Like I was talking to a blind friend of mine who was telling me a story about going home to visit her mother. And, you know, this, my friend is an adult and, you know, a very accomplished professional, like runs a large organization and super active in every aspect of her life. And she goes home and her mom insists on like putting the butter on the toast for her, you know, and she was like, "Mom, like, don't you know that I like run this organization and like I'm out there like crushing it every day?" And then at a certain point, she just had to realize, like, I think maybe this is just not a blindness thing. It's just my mom being my mom, you know, like buttering my toast.
Yeah.
And I feel like I feel that sometimes and I hear that, you know, and I think there are obviously times when it's like, no, this person is doing this because of some misguided sense of what my needs are. Mm. And they're compartmentalizing me and they're sort of diminishing me. But also sometimes like, yeah, middle school is hard, you know? And so I think not to say that that's what was going on with your example, but, you know, just to think through like the kind of nuance and complexity of that. Like I read a really challenging book recently called Chasing the Intact Mind by Amy Lutz. Do you know her?
No.
She's the mother of a kid with, and I'm like new to the sort of autism world. So I don't know if like severe autism is a word that people don't use, but like, you know, let's say non-speaking autism, you know, and she, the argument, I need to reread it, but the book is really in some ways like a anti-neurodiversity polemic. And you know, her argument seems to be that like, you know, the neurodiversity papers over a lot of these differences that I think you're describing. So like, you know, one example she uses is sheltered workshops, or, you know, the part of the Fair Labor Act called 14C, where there are these, basically it began for blind people, you know, now it's more often for people with intellectual disabilities, where you're paid in many states still sub minimum wages to go to a, you know, factory of some kind, and you're like, you know, pulling plastic sheeting around a package or something like that. And it's sort of this like repetitive labor. You might get paid like $1 an hour, but it sort of has the function of being like a, you know, like a, not group home, but, you know, you're getting sort of like disability services and there's like a community element to it.
Yeah.
And a lot of neurodiversity advocates, you know, make a very compelling argument that like, this is exploitation, right? Like, why would somebody with a disability have to work in non-competitive work, getting sub-minimum wages, when like clearly there are people with equal disabilities in the competitive labor market, you know, just getting the accommodations they need. And Lutz's point is that, you know, actually some people do benefit from sheltered workshops, and like the differences are actually, in some cases, they demand a sort of separate system. And so I don't have answers for any of this, but it's all just to kind of like point out the boggling complexity of teasing these things out.
Well, and it seems like,
and looking at each situation, I guess it's really hard to make generalizations about these things, I think.
And maybe that is where, again, like all the models we can be helpful to a point, but like that whole idea of the social model on some level is to say we're all the same if we do the proper work to accommodate our differences. And maybe we're not all the same, and maybe that's okay. And it doesn't create a hierarchy of human value, but that's what the way our society is often structured is to say, if you can work in a certain way, then you are more valuable. Or the more you write about, and I really appreciate this, I think a lot about it, independence and interdependence,
mm-hmm.
and I guess also dependence, right? That that sense of American and being independent and being able to do things for myself, that first of all, it's a false construct of the self, but then mm-hmm. second of all, to see it as like you're stronger or better somehow the more independent you are, I think is part of what, even within like the disability community, we can like play into that notion rather than saying, actually, there can be some beauty and value in interdependence. Although there also, it can also be a pain, right?
Like
it
just yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Since I wrote the book, I've been kind of checking out this podcast called Death Panel, and the hosts of it have a book called Health Communism, and it's really, really brilliant and intense. They're like the hardest core of the sort of disability media that I've encountered,
okay.
and their argument is kind of like a pretty explicitly socialist one. You know, it's like definitely healthcare for all, but furthermore, they talk about this idea of capitalism and the premium it places on productivity,
mm-hmm.
and that sort of creating this category of disability. And like, I think what you're describing about this sort of like will to independence is, I think in their analysis, that's just capitalism telling us that we have to produce in order to be valuable members of society.
Yep.
And I think that's a really compelling argument that I'm still digging around in there, but that's definitely where my thinking is heading in terms of that question.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I guess I have some questions for you that are related to language, which I think this is a little bit of a, you know, turning point, but it's all related. I'm curious to talk with you about some questions related to disability and language. I thought about this a lot when our daughter was diagnosed with Down syndrome, because I felt like I didn't have language at the time. I was, you know, didn't know about the idea of person first language, which would be, mm-hmm. you know, our daughter has Down syndrome, as opposed to our daughter is Down syndrome, or we have a Down syndrome baby, which is how a lot of people were describing her. But we'd also have people say, oh, your daughter is Downs. And it's like, no, that's not, you know, and so that came up a lot. But then there's also the language of, and there's the language of suffering, that is implicit. This actually, I don't know if you saw this, John McWhorter, who writes for the New York Times, had an essay a couple weeks ago in which he mentioned that he says suffering is baked into disability. So it's totally appropriate to say so-and-so suffers from disability, which I firmly disagree with.
Likewise.
Yeah. But I was like, okay, like he's
going
there.
Feel pretty good right now. I don't feel like I'm suffering at all at the moment. Believe it or not, having a great afternoon.
It kind of took my breath away just in terms of the confidence with which he asserted that suffering is baked into disability. So, so there's that. Then on the flip side of that, there are people with disabilities who are like, no, I am disabled. That is, that's my, or at least a part of my identity, and I'll use that language. So there's that whole aspect of language. Then there's also the metaphorical language, which, as you point out in your book, often one set of metaphors revolves around blindness and being able to see or living in darkness, all of those types of metaphors. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on just why language matters, how we can be mindful about the words we use, whether or not your language has changed as you've thought about this.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like I care passionately about language. I'm a writer, you know, and a reader. And so I think it's very easy for me to kind of go down the rabbit hole. And I think as just like a prelude to my answer, I would say that I try to pull back a little bit from focusing too much on language, because I think that it can often turn into like a culture war debate that misses the boat on like what the actual arguments should be.
Yeah.
In other words, like, if we're spending all our energy yelling about person first versus identity first language, and then meanwhile, like, you know, hospitals are shutting down masking within healthcare settings, and you know, that has a much greater impact on the lives of disabled people than than any kind of language thing. That said, language still matters. You know, but it, the question I get the most often is like, that I think is worth talking about is people will be like, okay, I'll see you later. And then they'll kind of be like, oh, I mean, we will encounter each other anon. And I'm like, no, like we will see each other later. Like disregarding the fact that I also have like some central vision where I will see you later, maybe depending on the lighting and whatever, but also just like, you know, Helen Keller has written about this. Like you can't just remove visual figures from the language, because if you do, like you will literally have no tools left to communicate, because the language is so intensely visual. Like, you know, since the Enlightenment or earlier, you know, the idea, you know, if you just look at the word Enlightenment or, you know, so many of our words for knowledge are visual. And I think that's okay. I think the thing that is a problem is the inverse, when you use blindness as a metaphor or a figure for ignorance. You know, and in some ways, like, it's sort of a natural corollary of using visual language for for knowledge, that if you're going to just like sort of intuitively do the opposite. But I think that is where you have to be careful. And that does sting, because then you see a blind person on the street. And if your kind of vocabulary is built up around ignorance, then your default assumption is going to be that that person lives in ignorance. And and that's a real, that, you know, that is sort of how people tend to look at blindness. It's it's like you're unaware of everything. I'm just thinking of a song a friend of mine who I met through the reporting sent me today. It's called "The Salt Is Heavier Than the Pepper." I don't know if that's exactly what it's called, but that's like his thing. Like when he became blind, like one of his like hacks was like, if you're trying to figure out which is the salt and the pepper and you want to do it without like tasting it, the salt is heavier than pepper. But like the song is sort of this whole thing where like somebody asks him how he knows he's awake if he can't see or not, and he's like, baby, like the salt is heavier than the pepper. Like I can blind people feel more, so you know, which I love. But anyway, so that's my answer about language in that realm. I just add the caveat that like these things are important and representation is important. You know, I think like the models of who people see, that's a little bit outside the language question, but like ultimately I think it can be a distraction. Like I got mad at the host of the New York Times Daily podcast, 'cause like there was an episode where like, you know, like here's what else you need to know today. Yeah. and it was like something like, I think it was like the SAG-AFTRA, the Actors Guild strike or the Writers Guild strike had like crippled the industry. And then like there was another news item. And then like the third one, something else was crippled, like you know, sanctions against Iran or something. And I was like, really? Like two cripples in one like news broadcast? And then I tweeted at him and then he was like, oh no, like, and just like completely missed my point and was just like, oh yeah, like the reason there was a repetition was because like we actually recorded those at different times. And I was like, no. Like, but, you know, and then like all these people, because of course it was like on Twitter. So people were just like, yeah, man, like he doesn't even get it. And then like that energy, I just felt like, what have I done? Like, I don't want a lot of people like mad at Michael Barbaro for saying cripple. Like, do I even care? Does it even matter? Like cripple is, I don't feel good saying it right now or reading it. Like it stung and like it's outdated and bad, but it's also like we got bigger fish to fry.
Right. And how, I mean, again, I do think when we're looking at, you know, official news publications, calling out those things, I think is probably important. But I also want to be someone who moves through the world with like a generosity of spirit and a graciousness towards others in terms of knowing that, we can use language without knowing, without having thought of the implications of what we are saying.
And suffering is much more, I think that one gets me more. And that one I think is important because it gets back to the blindness as ignorance thing. It's like, you know, there's a really great style guide that run by I forget the name of the university. It's in Arizona. I think Arizona State has like a disability journalism project. And one of the things they do is they put out like a disability style guide, just like the AP, you know, for like reporters to say like, how do you write this? And it's really thoughtfully done. And, you know, it's like a list of this, all these things we're talking about. Like, don't say imprisoned in a wheelchair. Don't say suffers from the disease, you know, like, and, you know, and I think just like the conflation of blindness with ignorance, it's like those things accumulate over decades to be like, well, I've, you know, to get the McWhorter effect. I haven't read that piece, but assume de facto that suffering is baked into the experience.
Yeah. It was an aside where he was talking about when we need to change our language and when we don't. And he gave that as an example of we don't because it's baked into the, and it was really startling to me for all the reasons you've given. And also, again, back to somewhat the political, if suffering and disability are conflated, which I don't believe they have to be, although disability does sometimes involve suffering and for various reasons that sometimes has to do with the disability inherently within a body and sometimes has to do with the social situation we find ourselves in. But also it can be a way to kind of let society off the hook from attending to suffering to say, oh, yeah, those just come together.
Yeah,
that's how it is. As opposed to why is it that there is some suffering associated with whatever disability we're talking about? So I got on that one was hard for me for sure. So
yeah, well, it's a tricky thing too because I think it's very tempting to kind of get activated in on the like disability justice, you know, thinking about disability rights, and then just sort of draw an equivalency to other civil rights struggles like, you know, like the Black civil rights movement or, you know, trans rights or LGBTQ movement, you know, feminism, you know, and in all of those cases, there isn't this sort of sense of like inherent suffering. Right. And so it's very easy to just say like this characteristic, being a woman, being Black, whatever, being trans has been marginalized, but there's nothing like de facto about being trans that, you know, besides the societal oppression that is related to suffering. Whereas with disability, you can make the argument like we are that disability joy is entirely possible, but there also is this added wrinkle of the fact that like a lot of disabilities do have like actual physical pain associated with them and that it's not just like this purely social model. And I think that's what you were maybe alluding to talking about the sort of insufficiency of the social model in some ways, that there are complexities that like the medical can't entirely discard the medical model even as much as we would want to, but there's sort of somehow like this, I don't know what the path forward is, but it does require us to, I think, complicate that image a little bit or that model.
Well, and I think you do a good job of complicating it. I'm going to read a quotation. This is actually from the introduction. The questions I'm still hounded by arise from the conflict I see between the value of disability, the beauty and power I've found in blindness, and its almost definitional sense of loss and exclusion. Mm. And that sense of beauty and power, loss and exclusion correspond coming together, like being inextricable somehow, perhaps. And I just wonder, like, why does that conflict, like remaining in that tension, matter? And how do you navigate that?
That's a good one. I don't know. Like, here's an example of something that happened to me in the past week that maybe will help me answer your question. So like one thing that I found is that like blindness and techiness go together very well. It's just like a lot of blind people get very into tech.
There's
probably many reasons, but the main reason I think is that, you know, information access is a big challenge of blindness. And so you sort of have to just by default figure out information technology. And as a result, there's like this immersion in that world. So anyway, I'm like, I've been doing a lot of that. I've been really going down the rabbit hole the last couple of weeks with this. And you know, and it's really easy to get that sort of romantic feeling. Like I was romanticizing it a lot, where I was just like, these blind hackers are so cool and I want to be like them and I'm becoming like them. I'm learning all these cool tricks, and like there's actually things that you can do in this world that like in this world of like blind hackers that I don't think you find in the mainstream, you know, tech world, and it's better, you know. And then I just like, nothing actually happened, but I just had this like moment where my attention cooled out a minute and I was like, but also like, wouldn't it'd be better just not to have to deal with any of this and just be back in the mainstream, you know? And like, I didn't stay there, but like, it was a sort of like a little bit of a self-correction of like, not to say that like, actually this is all bullshit and like none of this stuff is cool. Like all the original thoughts are still true, but then that other thing is true too, yeah. You know? And I guess that it's like the sort of negative capability idea that like, you know, you can sort of have two opposing ideas at the same time. And, you know, as a writer, I think I'm drawn to that also. I think that's one of like the like magic tricks that writing can offer you is that you can present an argument or present a picture of something and have two contradictions sort of living side by side and have that sort of synthetically, it doesn't have to resolve even necessarily, but it's just like, this is how this experience works. Like there's this thing and there's this thing and they don't match, but then you wake up the next day and they still don't match and you just go on like that. And so I think, I don't know if I have like a synthetic answer for you that will just like resolve that tension. But I think that like in some ways, like my book editor was really annoying until the end. And then I was really grateful about pushing me to find like these sort of universal themes in this experience. And I think that that is one of them. Like, I don't think that's specific to disability. I think we all live with these sort of tensions of like feeling like, you know, as Beckett said, I can't go on, I'll go on, you know, just sort of like being stuck, but also moving forward at the same time. There's a lot of different ways you could say it, but I think that is a human experience that disability definitely gives you an opportunity to experience in a pretty full way.
Yeah, I agree. And I appreciate that. And it kind of brings us back around to identity, because I have another question there for you. I've been thinking a lot about how I do not identify as a person with a disability. I do identify very closely with a disabled person in my daughter. Mm. That identification shapes and forms my identity, right? Mm-hmm. Like that is a part of who I am. And I think I could be wrong, but I think looking back, Penny's now 18, but when I look back to some of the early experiences of learning about her diagnosis, I think some of the wrestling I needed to do was because of a shift in identity, that there was a bit of a before and after. Like, I am now someone who is identified with disability and I wasn't before, or at least I was not in any way that I was aware of, because I do think there's some truth to the idea that we're all temporarily able in whatever ways we are. So, but I was struck in your book about how you write about both your wife and your son, and that they have perhaps this has always been true for your son, I don't know, but for your wife, like they've begun to identify with blindness because they identify with you. Like you are a part of their identity, even if they are not, you know, personally claiming any sort of like identity as a blind person. Yeah. And so I'm just wondering about that relationship between the identity of disability and identification with someone who is disabled, and whether there kind of are like things we need to watch out for, like those of us who are in the identification side, or if there are, if that's just a blurry line that helps us understand that this is not actually as much of a divide as it might seem.
That's a good question. Such a good question. Yeah, I mean, I think like I got excited in a very immature way about the sort of like very black and white separatist politics around disability when I first encountered it, you know, and it's just like, oh, what, like a sighted guy is running that? Like, well, then it's not good, because it's like we need, you know, the sort of NFB idea. And I still have a lot of faith in that, you know, and I think if you just look at the reality of it, you know, it connects to the larger representation debates in the US now, where it's like, you know, we need more, not just in media, but like, you know, in political representation, in business, you know, in education, everywhere. Like, you know, why are there so few minorities, let's say? And so I think that, you know, that kind of representation is important. Also, I think, you know, a sort of connected idea is people speaking for themselves. And I think one of the things that I really was struck by in researching the history of blindness is just how often sighted people speak for blind people and say what they need and can create systems that will work for them. You know, there's so many examples of systems that once the blind people are given sort of authorship and agency, you know, like then you get something like Braille, like, you know, it's not a coincidence right. or incidental that Louis Braille was blind and that he was the one to create the tactile reading system that superseded all the others. Mm-hmm. And that was the best path towards blind literacy. You know, and you see that again and again. So I think that, yeah, I mean, that's like the sort of bedrock. That's like the baseline. It's like you have to listen to the disabled person and you have to let them sort of drive and let them have authorship. You know, but I don't feel like the, you know, and NFB doesn't either. Like, you know, there's not so separatist that that like there's no room for allies. Mm-hmm. And I think like when you ask about the risks of allyship, I mean, I'm still a baby in this world, you know, so I don't have like decades of organizing, you know, and activism experience to drop on your dome over here. But I guess, you know, just from like my amateur armchair, I would say that I don't know, like one thing that I learned in hanging out in deaf blind spaces and like the limited amount of time I've spent there was just, you know, I think deaf blindness, there's a strong emphasis put on, you know, there's a lot of different names for them, but like, you know, hearing people or at the very least sighted people, often there's deaf interpreters, to help somebody navigate the space. And that's got a similar history where like, in the past, there's been a lot, and still in the present, there are people in that position, sighted people, who very much just like guide the deafblind person to a chair, put them there, bring them the thing they need, tell them what they think they need to know. And my friend John Lee Clark, who's a deafblind poet, has been just like revolutionary in pushing back against that and really organizing deafblind people as sort of rejecting that model and saying like, no, what we want are co-navigators, which is to say like, I lead and you follow and like you tell me what's going on. And I think that is the model across, you know, that's far beyond deafblind life. You know, I think anybody who's an ally to a disabled person needs to take that path where it's like, sure, like, and this is where we get back to interdependence, where it's like, sure, there is an exchange happening here. Like, you know, you might need my help doing X, Y, and Z, but it's not in this paternalistic, custodialistic way where I'm just going to pipe up and speak for you and yank you this way. It's like a human exchange.
Yeah, I'm wrestling as a parent because there's both the my daughter moving from childhood to adulthood, in which I need to shift my posture as a parent. And then there's also, okay, do I essentially like have a right or even a responsibility given what I'm equipped to do in this world to speak to other parents, not to, I don't pretend to be able to speak to people with Down syndrome about having Down syndrome or about what they should be doing with their lives. But I do feel a capacity and compulsion on some level to speak to other parents because there's been so much that we've learned along the way. But I've also found myself, even just in recent months, really having to pay attention to my prepositions, where I often say I'm doing such and such for Penny. And one of the, back to language, really important mental shifts I'm making is I'm doing such and such with Penny. And then asking, well, am I really? Or am I just like, oh, actually, and so it's helping me recognize the ways that I am sitting her at the table and bringing her the thing, you know, rather than saying, you know, you're 18 now, you can get your own mac and cheese or whatever it is, you know.
Totally.
And so I'm definitely like, feeling like I'm still navigating that space a lot, but I want, and I, again, I don't want to play into a false sense of like independence as the ultimate goal of humanity, but I do like the disability language of self-determination, of giving her as much agency over herself as she deserves. And that is, especially as a child becomes an adult, that's a growing sense of agency, but that agency doesn't mean she doesn't deserve support from people around her. It just means that that happens as much as possible on her terms.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you're asking all the right questions. I mean, it sounds like you're doing a good job by from where I'm sitting.
Thank you.
You know, and it's so interesting just thinking back to your example about like middle school is hard. 'Cause like in some ways I do hear you, and it sounds like you're describing a parent, you know, with a kid who's growing up, you know, and like there is a version of that process that happens with everyone, right? Yep. Where you're like, I guess I he's going to be in college and I'm not going to be there to like cut up his, you know, burger or whatever. And that totally exceeds disability. But of course, like when disability is in the equation, there's like a different set of kind of, there's different stakes maybe, or a different kind of like method, but like it is also, I think, not a bad thing to recognize that it is like part of the same intelligence and the same intuition that you have as a parent and as a person.
Well, and so this, I guess, leads me to what will be my final question, because I could talk to you for hours and I'm not going to do that. But I do want to come back around to this idea that we can compare the experience of disability, or in your case of blindness, to a more universal or human experience of limitation. And mm-hmm. I'm just curious to hear you think a little bit about what's helpful and harmful about those comparisons. Like what do we gain by universalizing, you know, the experience? And is there anything that we lose when that comes into how we're thinking about it?
I don't know if this answers your question, but I think one really important principle that I have encountered in sort of talking openly about this and just in living through it in terms of like those comparisons or the sort of conversations around identity has to do with I think self-determination is to borrow your phrase, a good way to put it. But like I was talking to somebody who told me that they were in recovery and that they used to be a heroin addict, you know, and then I was just thinking about that, like that comparison. And like, you know, for me to introduce him to a friend and be like, this is John, he's a former heroin addict, like that would be sort of such a terrible move, right?
Yeah.
Like
that's
for him to share if he wants to. And, you know, I think it's a similar thing with disability. Like, you know, if I want to make that comparison, if I want to talk about my blindness in this sort of intimate, revealing way, like I will. But I think that there's somehow like I don't know exactly where it comes from, but there's a kind of a feeling of entitlement that I think a lot of people have where it's like, it's kind of like the person on the bus who's like, you know, I mean, you see it in this very direct way on buses often where it's like, what's wrong with you? Right. Like, you know, but then, you know, it goes from the bus level to like, you know, the symposium at the academic conference level of like, you know, ableism and all of its, you know, different varietals and forms. But yeah, I think like the principle that would sort of cancel all that out is just to respect someone's privacy, but also just their own perspective on it. You know, and I think it gets back to that idea of autonomy, independence, agency, whatever you want to call it. Like, this is mine to define, not yours to define.
And again, that sense of particularity of experiences. So it's not that there are no broad human truths that we can learn from one another. And yet you also do a great job in the book of, you know, demonstrating just the breadth of experience, whether that's because of like actual biological process happening in terms of blindness, right? If you're born if you're born blind versus having a degenerative situation, that's going to be a different experience. If you are born into a particular socioeconomic class, or if you are born into, you know, all these different aspects, demographic aspects of life are going to play into particular experiences, not to mention, you know, just the variations on human personality and so forth. And I think, I just feel like it's important that tendency to universalize, which I very much appreciate. And, you know, again, it's one of the reasons I think I appreciated your book was that sense of, yeah, this really matters to me and relates to my life. And holding on to, yeah, both the particularity, but also what you just said in terms of respecting the dignity of the person to be able to tell their own story and not pretend that just because I can relate to parts of it, I could tell it for you.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, just to kind of circle back around to your first question about writing, you know, I think that as a nonfiction writer, like, I think that's what I find so challenging and rewarding about that kind of work is that you meet somebody in all their particularity, you know, in their very specific life. And your job is at once to like represent that, but also to like put them into some bigger context and to figure out like how their story is going to connect with something else that might be, you know, God forbid, a trend, you know, but or like a, you know, movement or a, you know, a new idea. And that's so hard, but also so rewarding and fun and interesting. And, you know, and I think just for anybody, I think if you don't have to be a journalist to participate in that, you know, I think in some ways what I did was to look outward, but also like to try to look at my own life in that same way. Like, who is this guy and where, how does his story fit in? So, you know, I would maybe encourage, I don't know if it's too cheesy, but like, I think that anybody can kind of look critically at your own life in that way. And it can be surprising what you find.
Mm. Okay. I said I had asked my last question, but I didn't, because I forgot that I recently renamed this podcast. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to wait to talk to you now under this heading. So we've just started calling it Reimagining the Good Life.
And what was it before?
It was called Love is Stronger Than Fear.
Oh, okay.
So, and anyway, I can talk about why, but we don't need to do that now.
Yeah,
But the Reimagining the Good Life is that sense of maybe what you think is going to make your life good is actually not. And maybe there are things you would think are not that great that are going to become these beautiful things. And I have one quotation from you that I'll read, and then I'd love for you to just kind of respond to the idea of reimagining the good life. So this is towards the end of the book. Exploring the world of blindness feels like digging through a field of paradoxes. Blindness is at once central and incidental. I'm blind even as I can see. The process of retinal degeneration has turned out to be one of the most generative experiences of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. So how can I reimagine the good life? I mean, I was raised in a quasi Buddhist tradition, and I think Buddhism is pretty good on reimagining the good life in terms of, there's sort of like a reflexive, impulsive sense of what's good. And then there's a maybe deeper sense of what a good life might be, you know, and the reflexive impulsive one is just like absence of pain, feeling good, like feeling entertained, pleasure, you know, and then of course the sort of nonstop striving to maintain those states is guaranteed to fail and then leads one into the depths of craving and sadness and et cetera, suffering. Yeah. There's John McWhorter suffering. It's like everybody, it's inherent in human life, not just in disability. And so the good life, I guess, borrowing from that tradition would be really begins with a recognition of that reality that you're not going to escape the contradictions and the sort of impossibility and the impossible feeling of life. And then that's actually like the first step towards, letting go of those desires and leading a good life that is really about acceptance. And, you know, I'm a little wary of the idea of acceptance, especially thinking politically, because, you know, you don't want to accept a situation, you know, so I don't think acceptance means just like being like, well, I guess, you know, my calculus professor told me that he doesn't know how he's going to teach a blind person, so I'm not going to learn calculus. Like, that's not the kind of acceptance. It's more like, this is hard and annoying and frustrating and confusing. But like none of those things need to stop me in my tracks. And, you know, I'm obsessed with Samuel Beckett, but, you know, I can't go on, I'll go on. And like in that overcoming, like there's a real terrible version of overcoming that people talk about with disability, like Andrew Leland, you know, lost 95% of his vision, but look at him now. He's running a 5K with his son, you know, but I think it's more just like that kind of like deeper overcoming of just overcoming, the basic contradictions that we all live with to find a place to be open and kind and curious about the world, including the deeply painful and irritating parts of it.
Thank you so much. And I do think you've got stories throughout the book that really are reimagining, what life as a father might look like and still be good. What life as a husband, as a writer, as a, you know, all these different aspects of who you are having to be somewhat reconsidered. And yet, And some, and there's loss in that. It's not to say there's not, right? But that there's also, and it's not to put a cheery spin of gain on it, mm-hmm. but there is also, as you wrote in that quotation, just there's something that's generative and beautiful and powerful there too.
Hmm. Thank you so much, Amy Julia. This has been a blast.
Thanks for being here. Thanks, as always, for listening to this episode of Reimagining the Good Life. And I'm sure you all who listen to podcasts know that it is really helpful to get reviews and to have word of mouth sharing of this podcast. And especially now that we're kind of taking a slightly new turn, we've got a new name, we've got a new vision in some ways for what this show is doing, I would love to invite you to just take 1 minute and offer a review. Take 30 seconds and text this episode to a friend who you think might appreciate it. Or if you want to spend even more time, send me an email at amyjuliabeckerwriter@gmail.com and tell me what you thought of this conversation, or if you have thoughts about guests who might fit into this this slot in the future. I just want to say thank you to Jake Hansen for editing the podcast, to Amber Beery, my social media coordinator and podcast coordinator. She does everything to make sure this happens. And finally, as you go into your day today, I hope this conversation helps you to challenge assumptions about the good life, proclaim the belovedness of every human being, and envision a world of belonging.